Hi folks, welcome to the A Minute to Midnight show. This is Tony coming to you from New Zealand, and with me on the show I have James Musker in London, and I always enjoy having James on the show. And James, you're always a very popular guest, and I'm sure today this will be another very interesting discussion. Having seen your notes, I know it will be. So welcome back, James.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Tony, and thanks for all the support that people have been showing me as well.
Yeah, it's really encouraging, actually. I see when, you know, people comment on the other shows and things that we've done, it's always overwhelmingly positive, and I really enjoy it. And as I've said to people many times, you've written a book that's extremely well worth buying. And still is, which you maybe just want to mention the name of that, and then we'll jump into the, you can tell us what this subject today is.
Sure. Yes, it's called The New World Religion and the Beliefs of the Elite, and it's available on Amazon.
And so, well worth getting, yeah. So what's today's topic?
Well, we're going to look at transhumanism and where it came from and where the cryptocracy, the hidden government, want to take us, and the links to transhumanism go back to the occult, alchemy, the Kabbalah, and strange science, basically. And so the aim of our chat is really to put the entire virus and vaccine and the whole medical emergency into greater context. So historically, and in particular religiously, to show that the hidden government's push and desire towards transhumanism is part of a much larger, all-encompassing religious agenda. So, yeah, we're going to look at that and get greater understanding of what's going on and look at the history of transhumanism, where it started from, look at some of the avenues that this belief has taken mankind. And so I think with this understanding, you'll gain greater context and background.
Sounds great. Yep. All right. Yeah. So where do we begin?
Well, some of the concepts surrounding transhumanism are deeply religious, and it's not all to do with science. And I would suggest that it fits in very well with their overall religious and spiritual agenda for humanity, that we will be going eventually into transhumanism. And it's part of their Masonic doctrine that they seek to fulfill their destiny, and that all humanity would gradually return back to the old world before the fall, back to their paradise. And in order for them to do that, they would perfect man as a god without God. And so they've tried via magic and other ways. Now it's time to try via technology. And so science can enable them to regain their lost divinity and to become gods. So in short, transhumanism is an amalgamation of evolution and occultism, and I find it a very dark and worrying chapter that is being opened up with the vaccine. And there are some good things here as well, because I do acknowledge that there might be benefits to the overall scientific endeavor surrounding transhumanism. But yet again, in the hands of the hidden government, the cryptocracy who really run us, it can only lead to slavery, death, and a two-tier system within the one world government. And so that's basically what it says in Genesis chapter 11, the story of the Tower of Babel story, that once mankind is all unified, then nothing will be impossible to them. And that includes people living forever. So it's mentioned in Genesis 2:22, where God says that man, if he eats of the tree of life, then he would live forever. And so God sent them out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground. And so this is what we're going to look at.
So for the those that don't know, what is transhumanism?
Well, yes, it's quite a wide definition, but it's the belief or theory that the human race can evolve beyond its current physical and mental limitations by means of science and technology. So the transhumanist typically desires to avoid death. Death is the enemy to them. And They seek to overcome illness, cure cancer and heart disease. And that's good in a way, but it's also about designing perfectly functioning bodies that can live forever, ever. And with the rapid advance of genetic engineering, it should be possible for them to eliminate imperfections from the human genome in future generations of children. So it's quite a eugenic sort of agenda that we're on. And of course, eugenicists, that belief is something that cryptocracy have been keen on for a long time. It's also about overcoming evolution, that we can now evolve ourselves in the direction in which we want, and that mankind has reached a tipping point in human history at which we can and must use technology to direct our own evolution. And with the help of new sciences and nanotechnology, AI, etc., we will go forward and reach for the stars. And for example, Ray Kurzweil, he predicted that by 2045, computers will surpass human intelligence and will begin to increase knowledge exponentially. And so human intelligence will no longer really be needed. Transhumanists are also keen to develop Homo sapiens, who was just another species that could be wiped out. And so to enable us, fear of extinction, that we wouldn't die out in the next asteroid disease or any apocalyptic event. So I'm not anti that, but I'm just saying that this fear of extinction will make us sort of droids and more likely to go for society and civilization to go in on itself. And of course, transhumanists have a pretty twisted view of Christianity, and they don't like the fact that Christianity accepts the inevitability of death and other biological limitations. And so they kind of preach a strange afterlife, that you can live forever or upload your mind into a robot, and that you don't need God to attain perfection and immortality. Human reason is completely sufficient. So it's a dualistic anthropology that transhumanists believe that the soul, or rather our consciousness and rationality, is separable from our body, that the body is the source of limitation and needs to be transcended. So in a way, they're kind of saying that humans aren't good enough. We're not strong enough. Mm. We're not able to run far enough and jump high enough and live long enough. And that is a bit of a worrying way forward, because it'll immediately create a two-tier society. And I find that their systems and that the people talking about transhumanism in general, they're idealists. They're far too, they concentrate on all the upsides that they see. They can't see any of the hidden problems, like the Terminator or the violent golem running amok. Yeah, Arnie. So, Frankenstein needs to be destroyed.
I remember using some clips from Ray Kurzweil, who is a head of engineering at Google, and quite a brilliant designer in many ways and stuff, but totally out there, really in the realms of bizarre, what he's wanting and his transhumanist beliefs and where it's all going and stuff. It's like, my goodness, sounds like a dystopian nightmare to me, not something to be strive to achieve, that's for sure.
Yes. At what point do we become non-human, and do we become a robot?
Yeah.
At what point? I mean, it's okay if your hand gets crushed in a terrible industrial accident or something, you get a new robotic arm. That would be a good thing. But, you know, this idea of uploading, we'll come on to it, the new sphere and the global mind towards the end, which is really the end goal. It's very, very concerning indeed.
Mm.
So these concepts go back a long way. And in fact, the first story, one of the first stories arguably ever written, was written by the Sumerians and later on the Akkadians around 4,500 BC, is the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was written approximately 1700 BC, where Gilgamesh sets out on a quest for immortality after the death of his friend and brother Enkidu. And so he tries to find a herb that's growing at the bottom of the sea. And so he plucks it from the seabed, but it cuts and mutilates his hand. So when he returns back to shore, Gilgamesh has this plant that will give him immortality. But the plant is stolen from him by a serpent, who instead consumes it and thereby gains the power to shed its skin, thus achieving perpetual youth. So Gilgamesh breaks down and weeps at his misfortune, and he doesn't find immortality. So one of the first sort of early stories is about kind of arguably transhumanism. And from there, the ancient Egyptians, in order for the pharaoh to reach the afterlife, the life force of the pharaoh would have to return to the corpse, and it was vital for the spirit to be able to recognize the body. And that's why they were so keen to preserve the body to some degree, hence mummification. So then the body would act as a bridge between the spirits of the deceased and the offerings provided by the living. And it's related to Osiris when he was killed and dismembered by his brother Seth. He was cut up and sent all over the Middle East, and his wife Isis then brought him back and brought the pieces back of his body back together, and then his son Horus brought him back to life. So with the opening of the mouth ceremony, which was done at Egyptian funerals on the 70th day, it was a reenactment of the ceremony that Horus had performed for his father. After his rebirth, Osiris became known as the god of the underworld. So that method of achieving immortality or eternal life was to try to preserve the body, which is not that far away from some of the scientists today putting bodies into cryogenic chambers, freezing people for the long term in the hope of them being reawakened and resurrected. So you can actually do that through Alcor. It costs about $200,000 US, and you can freeze your body and hope that they will bring you back. So,
Oh dear, yeah, that's not a great idea, that's for sure. Especially when your spirit's left, you wonder if they did manage to bring someone back, what spirit would actually be in there. But anyway, what about the Greeks and what's the
Well, they believed in ambrosia, which was their sort of elixir of life, which was the food of the gods, which gave them immortality. So again, it's a similar sort of concept. And the story of Prometheus, the divine fire, backfires when he steals the fire from Zeus, and then he gave it to humans, thereby improving their condition. But he ended up being punished by Zeus for this. And an eagle came and ate his immortal liver each day. So I quite like the take on that the Greeks have on these sorts of concepts, because for every advantage, there's sort of a payback that happens later on. And so there's a punishment or a macabre flip side. And the transhumanists aren't that aware of the flip side. And in the myth of Daedalus, for example, the engineer and artist, he used non-magical means to extend human capabilities. But in the end, the disaster happened when his son Icarus flew too high to the sun, ignoring his father's warnings, and the wax in his wings melted and he fell down to the ground. So I have a feeling that these sorts of Greek stories are quite illuminating upon what may well happen to us with transhumanism, that we're going to find out the hard way that the wisdom of the ancient Greeks and the pure knowledge of God of the ancient Hebrews is going to be correct, that we're going to find out that it really is a very ugly, grotesque, macabre, evil sort of future that they want to take us into. And of course, in the hands of the cryptocracy, there can be a two-tier society. And Francis Galton Darwin spoke about the hidden government being like the wild men, that they would remain unremoved from taking on the transhumanist sort of slave-like mentality. But surely some of those technological advances, they will also take on. So it'll be very strange. And this is what the virus is all about, taking us into. And it's mentioned also in Hermetic religions as well. So this concept in the Near East of Hermeticism, Hermes Trismegistus, and apotheosis is the belief that a person can become a god. And in the High Masonic tradition, this is precisely what they teach, that by the light of Lucifer, they can achieve godhood. And in the ancient world, it wasn't completely uncommon for man to become a god or to be a demigod, half man, half god. And many of the Greek gods, for example, like Hercules, were half. And also Roman Caesars like Caligula and Nero, they thought of themselves as gods. But it's difficult to know really where the precise line lies with whether they believe that man would become a truly powerful being, as in sort of the Christian sense of God being all-powerful and all-present, etc. Their concepts may have been a bit different about what being God really was. It wasn't as cut and dried as today. So the hidden families, if they can't achieve godhood through magic, then they're going to use technology, and they want to, they've got the whole human entire population to experiment on. And they've started off with the experimental vaccine.
Yes, that's a bit of a worry.
We've got Islam as well, where we've got this concept of the elixir of life. One of their prophets is Idris, and that there be a liquid or substance. And this was the drinkable gold, or the aurum potabile in Latin. And this kind of led in some way to the alchemical traditions in Jewish and Christian circles, which spoke of famous biblical figures drinking this gold to extend their lives, such as Enoch, Noah, and Adam. And the Ismailis later on preserved some of these more occultish Egyptian hermetic beliefs from Islam. And then we have the murderous old man of the mountain, Hassan Ibn Sabah, who founded the Assassins. And they were the hashish eaters who developed the concept of the deep mole. And they studied the occult, mastering methods for reaching higher planes of consciousness. And they became incorporated in some ways with the Knight Templars. And so the belief of the Assassins during the Crusader times became incorporated with the secret society of Knight Templars, who then slowly morphed into the Order of the Rosy Cross, which is why you've got the Red Cross of the Knight Templars also being the Red Cross of the Rosy Cross of Rosicrucianism. So the two sort of merged, and that's why these beliefs are present within Freemasonry, because those concepts went all the way through. And then we've got the Kabbalah. According to Gershom Scholem, who's a theologian academic, he died in 1982, and he studied the Kabbalah and worked out where it originally came from. And he said it was emerged in Spain around about 1280, and then later on it was written in Provence, France. And the Zohar, the Book of Splendor or Radiance, is the foundational work of the Kabbalah. And many Superman concepts, and this concept of going up the Sephiroths, of slowly getting back to God by climbing up the Luciferian ladder to get back to the Godhood, come from the Zohar and the Kabbalah. So we're going to look at the golem next then, Tony. It's a little bit comic, but these people, Kabbalists and some Jewish writers of the Talmud. The Talmud is a collection of Jewish commentaries on the Old Testament. they were keen on this concept. The Talmud itself was foundational during the Middle Ages to most Jewish thought, and it was a guide for the daily life of Jews. And so the term Talmud normally refers to the collection of writings named specifically the Babylonian Talmud, although there is an earlier collection known as the Jerusalem Talmud. And so in one of their Talmud volumes, Adam was initially created as a golem. And that word golemi is mentioned in the Hebrew in Psalm 139, verse 16, and it where it means my light form. So a raw material, an unfinished human being. But being the Talmud, they wanted to add to it. So the idea is that God created the golem first from mud, but it wasn't fully human. But then it was disabled. It wasn't able to speak. But then later on, God breathed life into the golem, as in Genesis 2:7. So you've got God breathing into the nostrils. Into Adam's nostrils, the breath of life, and then he became a living being. So a bit of a warped interpretation, but based on that writing, then we've got the Sefer Yetzirah, which is the book of creation, a further Talmudic book. And that it gives instructions on how to make a golem. That according to them, there was Jeremiah and his son. And when they created the golem, it became violent. And then the son had to kill the golem. And so there are various different stories about how to create the golem. And of course, the alchemists were mad keen to find out about this. What they would do is that they would write on the, make a figure out of mud of a sort of human. And then they would write the word emeth in Hebrew on the forehead. So aleph mem tau, which means truth, they would put on the golem, then they'd sing a song or do a dance and go backwards to kill it. But when they wanted to kill the golem, they'd then rub out the aleph, so that there was then the letters mem and tau, which spells meth, which is death. And that's where the word Methuselah comes from. So in Hebrew, it's actually marweth in the Hebrew, but meth, it can be also without the wow. Anyway, this is how they would kill the golem when it became violent. They'd rub out the aleph. And so the golem would finish. And so it's similar to the homunculus as well, which is another.
I suppose most people would, when they think of golem, they would think of Lord of the Rings, you know?
Yes. Well,
my precious.
Yes. Well, it does. Obviously, J.R. Tolkien, he mixed in all sorts of bits from Scandinavian mythology, didn't he? And he probably knew that Hebrew word. So. Yeah, that's where it comes from, the golem. And so then we'll move on to the homunculus, which is when they produced another human. And this was in a little test tube. They'd mix in some sperm and some horse dung and for 40 days. And then they'd do rituals over it. And then there would appear a little human, and then they'd feed it arcanum of man's blood for 40 weeks and all of this. And eventually they would form a little human that they would then deal with. And so some of these writings possibly were symbolic rather than literal, and they contained hidden messages regarding the process of spiritual ascension, possibly the concept of turning man into the perfect being. And it's mainly in the earlier writings are in the alchemical writings of Paracelsus, who died in 1541, and he was the father of toxicology, so toxins and chemicals having an effect on the body. And so it's related also to the philosopher's stone, which was a mythical alchemical substance capable of turning base metals into gold from mercury or lead. And via the elixir of life, they believed in achieving immortality. And this was one of the most sought after goals in alchemy. And it's not dissimilar to their concept of the great work, the magnum opus, which is the spiritual transition of man to a new Superman, which is transhumanism. Mm. So Freemasonry teaches similar things, that it is possible to become a god, and that it is the aim of that religion to become divinized. They intend to become a Superman. And so Nietzsche, he picks up on these ideas in about another 400 years, but obviously it's from a different point of view. Mm. Then we've got Isaac Ben Luria, the Kabbalist. He developed upon the writings of the Kabbalah, and his 8-volume Tree of Life book, written by his followers in 1573. Then we've got the torch of this sort of concept of transhumanism continues with John Dee. He died 1608. He was Elizabeth I's advisor. He was a sorcerer, alchemist, a hermetic philosopher. And through his colleague Edward Kelly, who was a spirit medium, they would scry and reveal their Enochian magic. And Dee's goal was to bring forth a united world religion through the healing of Roman Catholicism and Protestant churches, and recapture sort of the pure theology of the ancients. So an interesting character. Mm. And then this relates to the sort of developing Renaissance humanism, which developed in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries, as they began to rediscover the classics, going back to Plato and some of the Arab translations, such as Averroes. And Renaissance humanism encouraged people to rely on their own observations and their own judgment rather than to defer to every matter to religious authorities. And so slowly this concept of the Age of Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, developed. And it's said to have really started with Francis Bacon's book, The New Tool, Ovum Organum, 1620, which spoke about scientific method based on empirical investigation rather than revelatory and religious authority, reasoning or contemplation. And so Bacon advocated the project of effecting all things possible, by which he meant using science to achieve mastery over nature in order to improve the living condition of human beings. And Francis Bacon's book, New Atlantis, was published in 1627. And so the Enlightenment was well underway by 1688, when the Glorious Revolution in England happened, which is when James II went into exile and handed over the rule of England to his Protestant daughter, Mary II, who married William III. So during this period in France and Germany, these sorts of intellectual thoughts started in particular, and the sort of Enlightenment really got underway. And from these concepts, probably the most important discovery from the standpoint of transhumanism is that science and the uncovering of truth by empirical methods kind of started the scientific revolution. So in terms of secret societies during the Enlightenment, it was the start of lots of energy, and it was quite common during this time for the religious beliefs such as Catholicism to be mixed in with the scientific, naturalistic, occult beliefs that were present at the time. Religion, science, and the occult were really a revolving door. There was no clear demarcation between them. And so it seems that, looking back, those people were suffering from some of the many scientific delusions and suspicions. But I would argue that we're seeing the same thing today, yes. Tony, that we're seeing so many, scientific delusions and suspicions today that we haven't really moved on that much. And there are so many unproven scientific issues surrounding lots of issues. The vaccine is a brilliant example. It's completely untested on animals.
And I'm thinking of the whole green agenda thing as well, the climate change, global warming. And the first, straight away, I thought of Pope Francis, actually. Mixing all of the things that you just mentioned pretty much.
Yes, that it is true that science has got to come of age a lot more and stop being funded by the cryptocracy, because they're just bending it in the way in which they want. And so lots of science is not being done properly anymore. It's all about getting grants and saying this and that in order to maintain them. Yeah. So it's a disaster anyway.
Yeah. So right. You're talking about Francis Bacon. What about the Invisible College?
Yes, well, this is an important start, because this was a group of scientists who got together, and this group basically goes on for a few hundred years. It was called the Invisible College, started in 1660 by Bacon, and it was an attempt to realize in practical terms the Freemasonry and Rosicrucian ideas of brotherhood, of learning and enlightenment, which would help usher in the kind of utopia that they wanted. So technology enabling transcendence, which gave them a feeling that they were special in their age and that they were going to take humanity forwards into this golden utopia. And so I would argue that the cryptocracy of the day were jumping on top of that and pushing that along. So and the modern conspiracy in some ways under Jean-Jacques Rousseau, he was a philosopher, and he was basically a proto-socialist. And his writings started with the idea that man is inherently good and uncorrupted by society and living in a sort of naked state. And so he had this idea of the myth of the noble savage. That the it's not a derogatory term meaning barbaric, but the noble savage is man living as he should be, and that man had an innate sense within him of the natural law, which meant he knew instinctively what was right from wrong. And so it was the result of the outgrowth of man's instinctive disinclination to witness suffering that Rousseau said that all religions were equally valid, and that they taught morality in an equal sense, and that this natural law was what he wanted humanity to go forward with, and that in the end, that the state was corrupting what was going on, because if everyone lived in the old ways, they wouldn't need to be a state, therefore they wouldn't need to be ownership of private property. And so this is where the concept of not owning anything comes from, and that nature makes all humans equal, but society is bad and the state is bad, and that's what's making them unequal, and that property ownership was what was wrong. And so it's this sort of idea that was later heavily reflected by the Bavarian Illuminati, that was only to emerge about a decade later, that they were heavily influenced by this philosophy of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And they held the view that if mankind could get his morals correct, there wouldn't be a need for governments or monarchy and a need for property ownership, since a perfect state of society would emerge. And so their view was that it's only because society is warped and has private ownership that governments and monarchies are needed. So there's a direct link between Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the French Revolution and the Bavarian Illuminati. So it's very interesting, I think, just to make note of Jean-Jacques Rousseau in this story, because he's developing the concept of socialism and the brotherhood of man and this idea of one world religion. So yeah, it goes on. We've got the Masons starting in 1717, and we've got strict observance in 1751, and strict observance is where lots of Illuminati members were recruited from. Baron von Nigg, he was second to Adam Weishaupt, and he recruited many members from strict observance to the Illuminati. So they get mixed in with the House of Rothschilds, and the Jacob Frank, who was the fake messiah, the Sabbatai Zvi was the previous messiah in 1666, according to this strange sort of Jewish religion that emerged at that time. And Jacob Frank said that he was the reincarnation and the next Messiah. He said he was a reincarnation of Sabbatai Zvi. And so actually they were quite a small group, but they were based in Offenbach, not that far from Frankfurt, where Amschel Mayer Rothschild and his five sons were. And so there is a link between Jacob Frank and the Bavarian Illuminati, which has just been coming out. So 1782, we've got the Congress of Wilhelmsbad, which is when the doctrines of the Illuminati spread basically deep within Freemasonry over the rest of Europe. And going back to Jacob Frank, he died in 1791. And they were the cult of the all-seeing eye. They also spoke about Big Brother. And their goal was the annihilation of every religion, basically, and rebuilding the world so that it would be one. So the Rothschilds, there is a link there between some of the people that the Rothschilds happened to have within their business. Michael Geisenheimer, he was called. So we go forward with a sort of global conspiracy under the Asiatic Brethren, the secret society which accepted both Jews and Christians, and it had links again to the Frankists, and they were called Melchizedek Lodges, and they were linked in with Cagliostro and Rabbi Falk. The Egyptian Rite Freemasonry comes from there. Then we've got the Philadelphies, 1797, an outgrowth from the Bavarian Illuminati. And then a bit more on topic, we've got Thomas Malthus. He was an economist. His publication in 1798, an essay on the principle of population. And his father was a friend of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And obviously, we've got Malthusian economics and populations. His concepts were that populations grow geometrically and food production would only increase arithmetically. Therefore, whenever the food supply increases, population will rapidly grow to eliminate the abundance. And eventually in the future, there would not be enough food for the whole of humanity to consume and people would starve. So he was into that idea that populations would come and go, as you know. And so it was a fight. He really came up with the idea of the fight for the survival of the fittest amongst humans. It was a kind of proto-Darwinism that he spoke about. He was an Illuminati member. Well, he wasn't an Illuminati member, but he was funded by the East India Company, which in my mind is the start of the modern cryptocracy we see today. There are a few hints before then. But the new thing here is that the East India Company used the British government to help them with their business endeavors. So it was the start of a new system. And Malthus just happens to have been funded by and helped along by the East India Company, a bit like scientists today. So we're going to go fairly quickly through a couple more secret societies that are sort of carrying this strange transhumanist torch. We've got the Carbonari, 1814, started in Italy. You've got Giuseppe Garibaldi. You've got Mazzini. You've got the Marquis de Lafayette. He was in America and also France. 1837, you've got the League of the Just, which was Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, the Communist Manifesto. 1847, you've got the Communist League. Then you've got the Order of Sion, going very quickly. Moses Hess. Then you've got Skull and Bones, 1832. 1860, you've got the Alliance Israelite Universelle in France under Adolf Cremeau. And this was a Jewish organization that sought to help typically Algerian Jews who were given the rights to become Frenchmen, whereas Algerian Muslims and Berbers were excluded. And it is possible, more than possible, I would suggest that the protocols were actually written by this group and they were expanded upon later on. But the original writings probably came from there. Notable members, we've got René Cassin. He wrote the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And Charles Netter, he was one of the first settlers with it. He started a Jewish settlement in Palestine outside of Jerusalem, heralding the new era. And then we come to Charles Darwin, of course, evolution. And he was obviously influenced by Malthus, and his book on evolution was heavily promoted by the establishment of the day. The hidden government has always controlled the dialectic, and you've got Thomas Huxley, who was Darwin's bulldog, helped to propel the new evolutionary faith. Thomas Huxley is Julian Aldous Huxley's father. So we have this incredibly atheistic situation where evolution can be applied to practically anything you care to think of: the development of engines or social thought, the evolution of government systems, you name it. All manner of things can be evolved. But obviously, evolution only is only a theory, and it only kind of works if things are alive. So how can you evolve engines? It's just development, isn't it? So you see it, once you realize that, you'll see it everywhere. It's quite interesting. Mm. Evolution's a highly flawed concept anyway. So,
totally. Yes.
And if you get into arguments with people, it can be easier to argue abiogenesis, which is how life actually started. Scientists haven't even come even minutely close to starting to get to that. Mm. And you've got the idea of irreducible complexity for evolution, which I think is a real deal breaker for evolution, that certain biological systems just can't have evolved because there are so many small successive modifications that need to exist at the same time to make the system work. So it's very complex. And then we're going to quickly go through, they don't deserve our attention, but it's the torch of transhumanism is basically picked up through occultists such as Eliphas Levi, who affected Crowley, and Albert Pike. Then you've got Edward Bulwer-Lytton, who had a profound effect on Madame Blavatsky and the arrival of the New Age movement. And that ignited Swami Vivekananda and the New World Religion concept in 1893 at the first Parliament of World Religions. So going quickly through that, and then we've got the history of eugenics kind of starting around this time, that the belief in perfecting humanity via basically breeding programs, as far as I can tell, the concept of improving genetic quality. And that kind of involved, as far as I can tell, killing people who didn't fit in with their stupid requirements. So I make a joke of it, but it really is this eugenics idea. I just, you know, it's totally anti-Christian. Yes. And we've got in, it's 1907, the Eugenics Education Society started then, with the aim of promoting the research and educating the public about the benefits of eugenics. Prominent members were Francis Galton, Milton Keynes, Lord Balfour, who signed the Balfour Declaration and was in the Rhodes Secret Society with Milner, etc. Winston Churchill was there, Neville Chamberlain, and Margaret Sangster.
Wow.
And then forwarding 100 years, basically, in 1912 in London, we've got the family planning, and Bill Gates went to it, which was a 100-year anniversary of the original eugenics meeting. And so those meetings were held on an ongoing basis in the 30s. They sterilized mental patients, classifying people according to their mental ability, killing people who had disabilities, deaf, blind, poor, you name it, promiscuous women, gypsies, they killed them. So much of the funding for the eugenics studies movement was supplied by the Rockefeller Foundation, founded by J.D. Rockefeller. And that served as the arm of the family's wide-ranging plan for social change. And, of course, outside the Rockefeller Plaza in New York, we have the Luciferian statue of Prometheus with the inscription. Yeah, on front of the inscription reads, Prometheus, teacher in every art, brought the fire that has proved to mortals a means to mighty ends. So you can see the link to what we were looking at before, Prometheus and fire.
Yes.
World War II, we've got the Nazis. They were the first political expression of the eugenics of Nietzschean social Darwinism and the occult beliefs that would come to be collectively referred to as the doctrines of the New Age. Nietzsche was into the concept of suffering and the Superman, the Übermensch, and he foresaw the kind of death of God concept, which he was appalled by. The bizarre beliefs of the Nazis were not a sudden anomaly, but sort of an extension of the Sabbatean occult traditions by way of these groups that we've looked at. And Rosicrucianism, probably headed by Edward Bulwer Lytton, who used the swastika, which they identified with the Red Cross of the Rosicrucians. And so the doctrines of the Nazis merge with these ideas of Bulwer Lytton's The Coming Race, Madame Blavatsky, the theory of the Atlean origins of the Aryans. And they mixed those beliefs in with the German folk writings of Guido von Liszt. And the Nazi teachings were founded on the idea that the Aryan race colonized Central Asia, where they're responsible for transmitting the so-called Oriental Kabbalah, which survived in Tibetan Buddhism. So there's a link sort of eastwards there. And of course, in the New Age, it's very heavily coming from Hinduism. So after World War II, we've got the start of MK Ultra, which was an extension of the ongoing collaboration between the CIA and the Nazis, leading to Operation Paperclip, when the Nazi scientists were let off from their war crimes and Uncle Sam brought them over to America to help with their next set of issues. The Tavistock Society started in 1946 with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation again, when it separated out from the Tavistock Clinic started by the Milner Group back in 1920. MKUltra really got going in the 50s with the CIA and other American, Canadian and British agencies, as well as the UN, and it was linked to the Frankfurt School. And so all of this leads to transhumanism. And Julian Huxley was the first person to coin the term transhumanism in 1951 and bring it into the public domain. He was born in 1887. He was a biologist. He was a eugenicist, and he became the organization's first director general in 1946 of UNESCO. But he didn't last there very long, actually. He was only there for 2 years, because I think in those days they didn't particularly like his lefty depopulation strategies, and so they got rid of him. Mm. But his younger brother, Aldous Huxley, was born in 1894, and transhumanism has always been a goal of the elite. And this is what Brave New World is all about, written by him in 1932. And eventually in Brave New World, there's the 9 Years' War, isn't there, and the great economic collapse. And I'm hoping that this isn't predictive programming for what could happen next.
Yeah.
And that So that would make it 2029. Hopefully that won't happen. So some other Aldous Huxley transhumanist ideas were free Martins. These were the women who had been deliberately made sterile by exposure to male hormones during fetal development, but still physically normal, except for the slightest tendency to grow beards, is what he put. In the book, government policy requires free Martins to form 70% of the female population. And so when I was a boy, these were the two books, well, a teenager, these were the two books they were pushing. They were pushing 1984 and they were pushing Brave New World. And I think that continued up until fairly recently, that those were the two kind of cool books that you should read as teenagers. But my argument is that there's no surprise they were pushing those two books, because the hidden government want us to know about these things because it's part of their subtle programming.
So yeah, well, of course, so Huxley, well, Wells as well, and Huxley and Orwell were all friends and all part of the Fabian socialists. Yeah, the Fabians, exactly, yeah.
Absolutely, yes, they were. And They were a society that they started up in early on, just a bit before sort of the Rhodes Group got going, 1890s, that were keen to remold the world, smash it. There's a picture of Bernard Shaw smashing it with his hammer to remold it in the form that they wanted. So a terrifying concept. Why can't they just build back better? No, I don't mean that. But, you know, make it better. Why do they have to smash it up first? But H.G. Wells was a propagandist for the New World Order, and he pushed this idea of the world brain and transhumanism in general. And his concepts are linked to Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit priest who wrote about the new sphere and the global mind. In fact, the Phenomenon of Man book by Teilhard de Chardin was introduced with Julian Huxley. So the new sphere concept comes from the Greek word nous, meaning mind. And Teilhard developed the omega point theory, which speculates that all organism on Earth will reach a higher evolutionary point by merging into one planetized spirit. He argued that the omega point resembles the Christian logos, namely Christ, who draws all things into himself, as in Colossians, God from God, and through him all things were made, John 1:3. However, humans would have to merge their collective intelligence into one supermind through computer technology as a necessary first step in the collective evolution of the universe. And Teilhard writes briefly but positively about these issues of the group mind and young science bringing us, new science bringing us cybernetics. So this is the point of all evolution. Up to this stage is the creation of a collective organism of mind. And in Childhood Ends, which is Arthur C. Clarke, the destiny of humanity, as well as most of other intelligent species in the universe, seems to merge with an overall cosmic intelligence. That's what he put in his book. And so,
what is the name of the book?
It's In Childhood's End, the destiny of man is to mix together. And of course, it's kind of reflected actually in the 2001 A Space Odyssey concept as well. At the end of the movie, they sort of just merge into this sort of tunnel, don't they? So super intelligent computers that will merge the world library that he predicted, Clark predicted, would be ready by the year 2000, that would then merge into the world brain. So this is the new sphere. But it sounds terrifying to me. And we've got to bear in mind Revelation 9:6. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will escape them. That is a heavy statement. If you're going to upload your mind into this world brain concept, and this is what you think is a good idea, well, I think you might be in for a horrible shock, because it's in the hands of the hidden government, and we know they have all of this occultism going back, as we've just stated. And so I think this idea that now we've got the vaccine and the entire medical emergency, we've got this sort of idea that capitalism has been the way forward, and that it's been about competition, and that if you work hard and you can also be a billionaire by working hard. But that's not really the way it is. The hidden government can't share power in any real competitive world. That they never allow true competition on any cutting edge technology. It has to be in their hands. And so if they want to maintain control, the way that it works is that a good product service is either open to the market or closed. And the door has been opened to these billionaires. And we see this with the medical emergency, that we should have known about it, that it was controlled right from the start. But they can't allow competition in any high-end technology. It has to have been opened up to them. And so Bill Gates, he's a classic example. His business from the start was opened, mandated, and pushed along by the secret services. high-end funders and enablers who opened the doors to his business right from the start. In order to have complete surveillance in the world of computing, you need one computer system, and that is Microsoft. You can't have 10 others. You basically have one. And so, in other words, to conclude, there hasn't really been any competition. And this is why the science is also warped. There hasn't been any competition in any of these new technologies that are coming out. So how much more will there be with transhumanism? These people work from the government at the top. They're heavily financed by them right from the start. Or they come up with this cock and ball story about them starting in a garage. Bill Gates in a garage, they're working hard, and Jeff Bezos delivering his books on his moped in 1994 from his garage. I don't know if he was on his moped, but I'm just painting the picture. That it's rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. They didn't start in their garage. Bill Gates was probably tapped on the shoulder. We think you're a good guy for our IT systems. Come and work for us. And we need you to develop this new computer system. And we hear that you're the main guy. That's why he dropped out of Harvard. It's not because he started a business in his garage. And there are lots of others. Michael Dell, he's the same, started in a garage. Google started in a garage. Hewlett Packard and Richard Branson. He should have gone to jail, but they let him off because of the VAT fraud. Also started in a garage or a houseboat. So we're trained to be optimistic and that to do well, and that, you know, we should run after the money, the Protestant work ethic and things. But really, the world is a closed shop, and power at the top does not tolerate anyone coming in. And so they actually eliminate competition, not create it. So in this respect, capitalism is a fraud. And I think we're seeing huge crony capitalism at the moment. So that's a whole nother subject. But yeah. So then, Tony, I'm going to finish off. Well, unless you've got questions, but we've got Stanley Johnson. I just wanted to mention that Stanley Johnson is a bit of a smoking gun, really, because he worked on depopulation for David Rockefeller. In this book, Just Boris, written by Sonia Purnell, which is a biography, she mentions that in the late 1960s, Stanley Johnson was working for the World Bank, and he had a new job as a project director to the National Policy Panel on Population Control, chaired by none other than John D. Rockefeller. So, after 12 months, he was there for 12 months on the panel reporting about population control, and this resulted in the formulation of the United Nations Population Agency, and President Nixon was very keen on it, and Stanley Johnson was there working, doing this, and then he was given an unexpected check by Rockefeller for $10,000. And then Stanley Johnson said, "I've been dogged by good luck all my life." So that's what it says in the book. Yeah, he was dogged by good luck. Yeah. And then he writes a book in 1980 called The Virus. Have you seen that? It's on Amazon there. I haven't read it, but I think it's a book about a government releasing a virus to bring about depopulation. And so that's over 40 years ago.
Wow.
So to conclude, I think that their ideas are to try to create the platonic sort of three-tier system, them at the top, the drone workers at the bottom, and then the enforcers in the middle, and that they want to take us into transhumanism, which is their sort of conclusion of their own religion, and that this is why they don't care telling us a few lies here and there. It's all justifiable and allowed. It's their beliefs that are coming out. And so now we find that we're one giant human experiment.
Yes.
So, and we recently learned that Vanguard and BlackRock are basically running most things. Their shareholdings are so, as you mentioned in your video, Tony.
Yeah, with a few foundations. A few obvious foundations as the front. Yes, there's this very small group, really. controlling the whole thing, everything.
Yes, it's very, very poor situation. All those academics talking about economics and sociology, and you know, they're miles off what's going on because they're not taking into account the conspiratorial aspect, which is right in front of our right in front of us. So they run the world. Democracy is, I'm afraid, pretty much dead. Medical freedom is looking out of the window. But we need to trust Christ, get back to holding firm that he is sovereign, God is sovereign over all things, and that he can flick the hidden government off, you know, like a pea from his kitchen table.
Yeah.
So we should stay close to Christ.
Yes, definitely. Yep. I mean, the future is not looking good from a human point of view. But yes, anything, well, what, no matter what happens anyway, we have to trust in Christ, and that is our only salvation. These transhumanists, and you know, whole idea is just, it's craziness, but people think it's just some sort of conspiracy theory, but it's actually it's conspiracy fact, and as you've pointed out, has a long history of getting to where it is now.
Absolutely, yes. It is a very, very worrying trend, and it may bring some good things, but in the hands of the cryptocracy, it will only create a system where you're being upgraded all the time, and a two-tier society, and it's very... it's a very bad route. And it's interesting to note that there's not really enough proper debate going on about it. We're just being slowly bulldozed into it.
Yes.
And the virus, and the vaccine idea is just the first start of them mucking around with our genetic code. And so this really is the culmination of their kind of religion, I think, possibly more than the New World Religion concept. I do believe that'll come out later on. And I put it in the book that it was a neural hive network, but we couldn't, I couldn't see what, you know, one part was, and that was the virus. So I've been finding myself running a bit low on compassion, Tony, with people, but I just want to say, you know, praying God should give that back to me and and to everyone. Don't let your compassion run cold because you think that you can see all of this and stay humble, because you know, that way God can have his say.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. This can be frustrating because you can see what's going on and the majority of people haven't got a clue. And, you know, it's, it feels like you're banging your head against a wall trying to tell most people what's going on. They just don't see it and don't want to see it. And yet it's right there staring at you in the face.
Yeah.
And it is a bit frustrating. But anyway, hopefully more and more people will come to realize what's really going on. And as I see it called it in the last video, it's not really conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy fact. So, yep. But anyway, absolutely, God has an answer for all of us as individuals. And that's the main thing, the most important thing.
Yes. Don't let your compassion run dry. Keep going.
Yeah. Well, thanks, James. Thanks for there's a lot in that, a lot of food for thought. And it's probably one of those things to listen to a couple of times and go back and actually look at who some of these people are in a bit more detail. Because you've done a good job in outlining exactly, you know, where this all started, and we can sort of see where it's all leading.
Yes, that's right. Well, I'm trying to put it all into a book, but I seem to be so busy with my normal job that it's taking me a bit long, but I'll get there and get that out to everyone, hopefully, soon.
Oh, that'll be good. Yeah, your other book, which you might want to mention again, is definitely great and well worth having.
Yes, thanks. Well, yes, it's there on Amazon, The New World Religion and the Beliefs of the Elite. It was written before the virus, but it does mention the virus, but it's talking about this slow syncretic forcing by the cryptocracy, the hidden government, into greying out all our beliefs, knocking us down so that we are sort of amalgamated into what they think we should be doing, eventually leading to this sort of neural hive network Luciferian religion that I think they eventually want to take us into.
I don't think it's going to be that far away. It's accelerating too, how it's going. But anyway, yes. So thank you heaps, James, for being on the show again.
Pleasure, Tony. Absolute pleasure. Thank you. God bless you.
Yes, and God bless you too. And hopefully we'll do another show before too long.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Awesome. And folks, remember our website is aminutetomidnight.com. Visit it, bookmark us, go down the right-hand side of the website page, enter your email down there to receive notifications of all of our shows and articles and so forth, which we put on aminutetomidnight.com. We do also have a Rumble channel, a BitChute channel, a YouTube channel, and an iTunes channel as well. A Minute to Midnight is run 100% by donations, and if you want to help us out, you can donate at aminutetomidnight.com. We really do appreciate people that help to keep us and our show running through donating. So yeah, if you can help us, that'd be great. The music used, I have written, played and recorded, and you can download some free music at aminutetomidnight.com as well. So that's it for this episode. God willing, we'll be back with another one in a few days' time. In the meantime, God bless, stay safe, and have a great week.